I'm Steven Steigman, sitting in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. The internet has certainly opened up the world to anyone with a computer. It's also created entire industries centered on internet products like the iPhone, Xbox, and TiVo. And as we're becoming more dependent on the net, some are questioning its direction and who's controlling it. Today, Michael Sowers, the traveling librarian, joins us for a conversation about the salvation of the internet, which he says lies in the hands of its users. We'll discuss digital rights management, Creative Commons, and other copyright issues. We'll examine how library services have changed over the years and how to make the most of search engines. Later this hour, a report from Lee's Summit, where thousands have gathered to hear Republican presidential candidate John McCain and his running mate Sarah Palin. It's Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steven Steigman. Steve Kraske is on assignment today. The personal computer created an internet where anyone with a keyboard could be master and commander of the World Wide Web. Now internet-centered products like iPhones, Xboxes, and TiVos can't be easily modified by anyone except their vendors and are killing the innovation of the once-open internet, according to Jonathan Zittrain, co-founder of the Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Is the internet on a road to tight restrictions, and how can we stop it from becoming a system regulated beyond usefulness? We'll talk about it today. Also this hour, Republican presidential candidate Senator John McCain and his running mate Governor Sarah Palin are in Lee's Summit. KCUR's Dan Verbeck will join us to describe the scene and what he's hearing at the candidates' talk. But first, the internet restrictions, digital rights management, and much more. Joining us today is Michael Sowers, also known as the Travelin' Librarian from the Nebraska Library Commission. He's one of the top people in this country who teach libraries how to best use the internet and other technology to help their users. That's you and me. Michael, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Well, Michael Sanders, do you agree with Jonathan Zittrain's argument that the internet is on a doomed course?
I wouldn't say it's doomed necessarily, but there are a lot of folks out there, corporations and that want to control it and in maybe to keep their own profits, their own business models going, and they say they want to do it to protect us from, you know, viruses and spam and all that other stuff. But there's a lot of downsides in trying to do it that way.
Well, you give us some examples of how the internet worked, let's say, early on, 2 decades ago, and how it's controlled now.
Well, I mean, it started out as a completely open system, a bunch of geeks getting together saying we want to be able to hook our computers together and work together. And the technology behind it completely changed it, because in the old networking ways, a central machine goes down, the whole network goes down. Mm-hmm. The internet, everything's a separate piece. So one section of it goes down, the whole internet doesn't go down. It continues to work. But...
But that's changed.
Well, I mean, it has and it hasn't. The underlying technology is still the same, but now with higher bandwidth and faster connections, ISPs are starting to put bandwidth caps on it, say you're not allowed to use peer-to-peer systems because you could be using it illegally to violate copyright. In fact, Comcast just kind of got... smacked a little bit by the FCC for blocking certain types of traffic across their networks. So in response, they said, okay, you now have a cap. This is how much bandwidth you're allowed to use every month on a, quote, unlimited account.
Well, won't that have to be modified? I mean, as the internet grows and as we start distributing huge, huge files, won't those caps have to be lifted at some point?
Well, I mean, there weren't any caps. Now they're starting to be caps. And this just happened in the last week, and people are trying to do the math to figure out how much bandwidth does something take, where you've got your Xbox and your computer and your television hooked up to the internet. I sat in my hotel room last night and watched a movie streaming from Netflix in HD. That used a lot of bandwidth.
Sure.
It was a beautiful picture. But
your hotel internet connection had enough bandwidth to cover it?
Oh, yeah. No problem.
That's good, because I found that that's often not the case.
Well, I did plug in with the wire instead of using the Wi-Fi. Oh, okay. That gave me a little better connection.
Is that a good idea to plug in with when you have the choice between a wire or wireless?
Oh, definitely. The wire is always faster.
Isn't the internet just kind of a victim of its own success?
Partially. That's where Zittrain talks about things like spam and viruses, and with everybody connected, that happens. So some of the control is to say, well, we're responding to the bad things that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the iPhone would be a perfect example
of
that.
Tell me about the iPhone. It's a beautiful piece of technology. Everybody seems to love it. But you say it's got its problems.
Yeah. It was found out that with the new iPhone, people can write applications that you can purchase and download or give away for free to the iPhone. But somebody found out that there's actually a kill switch that Steve Jobs has in put into this, where they can literally create a list of applications they do not want to allow to work on the iPhone. Now, the justification of this is that if somebody writes a malicious application mm-hmm. that could cause problems to the whole network, they want to be able to switch it off. But already in two cases, Apple has said, we don't like that application, and turned it off.
Tell us about those two applications. Let's start with one that just kind of shows a ruby.
Yes, this was an application called I Am Rich, and somebody created this application, and you buy it for, I believe it was $999.99. That was the maximum allowed.
Why was that the maximum allowed?
The application store, that was the max. Why would you charge that much for anything, I think?
I was going to say, who would pay $999 for that?
Well, eight people did. And it was an application that just said, I am rich, and you pressed on it, and it showed a glowing ruby on your iPhone screen, and that was it.
That's all it did.
That's all it did.
So people bought this just because they could buy it, or did they go ahead and show their friends, I've got a ruby?
Well, I think that was the point. I mean, it's called I Am Rich, so you obviously have money to blow on something completely useless.
So
like
you
that.
Can't copy that and distribute it to all your friends?
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay. And tell us about the other example.
The other example, I don't know a lot of the details, but it was basically an online comic book that you could download and view on your iPhone, and the folks at Apple decided that it was just too violent and kind of was against their community standards, so they pulled that application also.
Without getting too graphic, no pun intended, how violent was this? I mean, what made this different from any other, you know, manga type? Well, I mean, not all mangas are violent, obviously, but I've seen some.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any actual images from the comic itself, but it was pretty darn extreme from what I understand.
Okay, so violating kind of almost social norms.
Good taste.
Oh, good taste. Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the evolution of the search engine. What was the first search engine like? In fact, I was thinking last, I can't remember a time before Google. BG.
that there was a time before Google, yes. Pretty much, I mean, Yahoo was kind of the first, but at first Yahoo wasn't really a search engine. It was a directory. It was just a listing of categorized sites on the net.
Mm-hmm.
The first major search engine that I recall running into while I was in grad school was AltaVista. Which was you put in a keyword and it
now
gave you back a list of results. Yes.
Now it's coming back. Mm-hmm. And what happened? Tell us about how a program like Google worked differently from those search engines like Yahoo or AltaVista, or how it worked, why it became so popular a few years
sure.
ago.
Sure. Well, the original search engines worked on some very basic principles that databases worked on that, you know, I went to library school. I took a whole class in this pre-internet.
Test will be after the show.
Yeah, exactly. So you put in a keyword and it would rank the results based on, like, was the keyword in the title of the document or the body of the document? How many times did it appear? Did it appear towards the beginning or mm-hmm. towards the end? The idea of it was called relevancy ranking. Google came in and really kind of turned that over on its head and said, well, with the web, you have all these hyperlinks, and people must link to information they think is good. So one of the central things underlying Google's ranking is how many other websites and the quality of those websites link to a particular result. So the idea is that if more sites link to it, it must be more popular, it must be more accurate. So it is basically a popularity contest. And when this is explained to a lot of people, they kind of look at me funny and say, well, that can't work, can it? And I look at them back and I say, yeah, but are you complaining about your Google results? And most people say no.
What percentage of the world uses Google now? I mean, do you have friends who use other search engines? Well, I guess you
no.
do because you're in this business. But out of ordinary casual users like me, who doesn't use Google now?
That's a very good question. I mean, it's Google's a verb at this point. You know, you
right.
Google someone.
Right.
It's pretty much the standard.
Tell us about some of the newer search engines. What's coming down the road?
one of the things I've been looking at is something called data visualization and the idea of graphically representing search results. So, you know, you look at your typical Google search and it's a list of text-based links.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at a web search engine such as Kartoo, Kartoo.com, where you get your results, but they're represented graphically, visually. So each result is a page on the screen, and the larger the page, the larger the icon, the more relevant it thinks it is to your search you are doing. There'll also be words spread out on the screen, and as you take your mouse and hover over one of the icons for a page, it will draw lines to the words that appear in that page. And if you hover your mouse over a word, it will draw lines back to the pages that show up. So it's graphically representing the relationship of the results to each other, not just to your search query.
Is Google's new web browser doing this in a sense, or is some of the same type of technology?
No. At this point, Chrome, new web browser, which came out now just a week ago, is...
How many serious security flaws have they found so far?
Just one that I'm aware of.
Okay.
And I haven't heard that there's a fix, but I haven't checked my, you know, news feeds this morning. Pretty much they're just focusing right now on the browser technology. As far as I can tell, Chrome is not really interacting with their search functionality.
Hmm. Do you foresee a time when we won't have to be tethered to a PC or even a phone-type mobile device where we'll be able to get information just by holding up a screen or saying a few words out loud, you know, a bit like Star Trek, you know, computer, search for... I'm looking around coffee mugs.
Well, I mean, when you started the question with, you know, do you see a day where we're not going to be tethered? I thought we're already there.
Right.
I mean, I looked up directions to where I needed to go this morning on my cell phone using Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I wasn't really tethered to a wire in that case. Oh, I try not to worry about 5 weeks from now, let alone 5 or 10 years from now as to whether we're going to get there. But I voice commands, I'm sure, will eventually catch up. I mean, it's the hardware is there now. That was the problem years ago, was that the hardware couldn't process the amount of voice data coming in. It's getting better.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Steven Steigman. Steve Kraske is on assignment today. We're talking with Michael Sowers, the traveling librarian with the Nebraska Library Commission. He speaks this evening at 6 at the Linda Hall Library of Science, Engineering, and Technology. You'll find more information about that event on our website at kcur.org/up-to-date. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do. There are two ways of doing this. You can take part in our conversation on our website. Go to kcur.org/up-to-date and look for Join the Discussion. We'll follow your posts and read some of your comments on the air. You can also give us a call right now at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or again, online at kcur.org/up-to-date. We've come a long way, Michael, from the card catalog, haven't we?
Yes.
In one word, yes. Tell us about the first kind of... computerized catalog. How many years ago? What kind of information did it? Was it just taking all the information from a card and putting it on the computer?
Pretty much. That's ultimately what online catalogs do. You can add more now because of the fact that you're not limited to a small index card with a hole in the bottom of it.
Sure.
So you know, newer catalogs are adding things such as book reviews and dust jackets and things you just could never put onto a card. And also some of the newer systems coming out are starting to add sort of the social and interactive features such as writing your own customer review, tagging items with user submitted keywords, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about the digitization of journals, magazines, and such. It used to be that when you looked up an index, you went to the shelf, you pulled off a old roll of microfilm or a small microfiche. Where did it go from there?
Well, at this point, it's purely going digital. The fiche is still there. Nobody's getting rid of that.
Mm-hmm.
The print, a lot of libraries still have the print indexes and that, but a lot of the print indexes have just kind of stopped updating and have gone completely electronically. And in a lot of cases, those are full text searches now as opposed to just looking up by a particular subject.
Mm-hmm.
So there are benefits to that. In a lot of cases, you can now get a complete image, if not just the text of the item, right into your system. But, you know, I want to let people know those databases are not cheap.
They're not cheap to the library?
No, they are not cheap to the library at all. They range from expensive to outrageous. And
give us a ballpark figure. I mean, I guess it depends on the size of the library and the number of users and things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. That's a lot of things.
Ballpark.
Some of those specialized journal databases can cost $20,000, $30,000 a year. Easy.
A year?
A year.
But at the same time, though, if they're full index searches, doesn't that then allow the user to just pull up all the information instead of having to subscribe to all these journals?
Well, yes. I mean, there are benefits. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But if the library gets its funding cut, or the price goes up too much the next year to fit within their budget, when you had print, you bought it, you owned it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing this online digital access, you're licensing it. So if you can't pay the license, you lose the content.
So even if you license it for a year, you're not downloading all the information.
No.
You're providing a link. Your library is providing a link to a central server someplace that has all the information. And if you can't pay your fees next year, out the window.
Correct.
What percentage of journals are online now? If you include like academic journals mm-hmm. as well.
I really don't have a solid number. I would probably say easily more than half. But
uh-huh.
There are some that just still aren't. There are now whole journals that are just completely published online in the first place and don't even appear in print.
Hmm.
So it really varies. The more specialized, I would like to say the less likely it is to be online,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot of really specialized stuff that's only online and not in print either.
I've always thought, you know, I've been through a number of university libraries over my career, and I go through the stacks and I look at these journals that are still in print, and it's like they've never been touched. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how many people look. I mean, you pay $20,000, $30,000 for this online access to a database. What percentage of those databases are actually going to be used by the library user?
A lot of that is going to come down to how well the library promotes it to their users.
Hmm.
So, you know, if you just have it and don't tell anybody, nobody's going to use it. But, it's going to come down to promotion.
Right,
really.
Right. 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Should there be more oversight of the Internet, and who should have it, and what are your concerns about the Internet, and where do you see it going in the future? You can also take part in our conversation online at kcur.org/uptodate and look for Join the Discussion. Let's say hi to Jonathan, who's driving on I-70. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Yeah, very interesting. I have a brief comment, and that is at risk of appearing or sounding older than I actually am. To me, the computer is so overwhelming and so quickly changing in its technology that if I literally buy a computer, I've already got old news, if you will. In other words, the programs have moved on in many respects. Now, I know it's very usable. I'm clear on all that. I raised a son who is a computer programmer. But for me, a truck driver who grew up, you know, out playing kick the can, not playing video games. My legs are stronger than my thumb. I just can't. I feel lost sometimes. You know that everything, like I can't blog well because I pass typing because I played football.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wish a computer. Just my comment is, if they could make it more easily accessible and usable for all people, so to speak, I think more people would be in it, not just that younger generation.
I think, go ahead, Jonathan, sorry.
Well, my question is, I can't even put a flyer for a pizza company on a mailbox. That's against federal law. That's someone's mailbox. Why is it when I hook up my computer and I go online, you know, get my internet service, that if I open an email, I'm subject to me having to fend against everything from viruses to cookies to everything.
Oh, boy. Here's a whole other show.
I mean, I'm just asking, why was it never thought that I purchase my computer, I pay for my internet service?
Mm-hmm.
What right does someone else have to just go within my system and say, hey, we're going to find out what you're shopping for, what your favorite websites are, and so forth and so on? Why do I have to defend against that when I don't in my own mailbox?
Jonathan, let's see if we can get an answer here. Michael, what about his question?
Well, it's perfectly legitimate. I mean, that's one of the things that Zetrain is saying one of the justifications for this control. Part of the problem in solving that is the internet is global. So, you know, who should be in control, if anybody? That's going to be the central question. You know, the U.S. mail system, U.S. federal government, the French mail system, the French government. who's in control of the internet in that case. That is the downside to being connected, is you do open yourself up in some instances. And so there's always a good and a bad to balance. As for the age, don't assume it's just the young folks. There are plenty of folks. I think of one gentleman who does a video blog on YouTube who was born in, I think, 1924. And he posts once a week and talks about his life and reactions to things going on in the world and the internet. And it's wonderful. He just sits in front of his computer, hits record, and then uploads it to YouTube.
Hmm. Well, that brings up a good question, which is, how do libraries use the internet technology for outreach, or to kind of bridge the digital divide?
Well, for the outreach, mostly at this point, it's your standard website. Many libraries and librarians are doing blogs, putting up wikis around particular topics of local history, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that would be kind of the standard outreach. For bridging the digital divide, in most cases, it's providing public access to the internet, providing public computers that people can come in and use. And access that way. We just launched a grant in Nebraska. We're going to provide equipment to 48 public libraries across the state to provide Wi-Fi access, so people can come in with their own laptops, mm-hmm. or people traveling through town. So the bridging the digital divide is purely through offering access, I would say.
Well, what percentage of library users go to the library not to read or check out a book, but to use the internet?
If you want to be a cynic about it, more people go in to use the internet than to check out a book. I wouldn't necessarily say that's purely accurate, but find me a public library who says we don't have enough computers to provide people access, or say they do have enough mm-hmm. to provide access. There's very few of them out there. You go into any public library of any size, those computers are being used.
Hmm. Well, if you're a librarian and you have a question for Michael Sowers, now's the time to give us a call, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also go online at kcur.org/up-to-date and look forward to join the discussion. Michael, libraries have filters on their systems. Why do they?
Well, some do, some don't.
Do most?
Again, I don't have specific numbers. Uh-huh. This has been a big issue in libraries ever since the internet came into the library. There are polar opposite opinions on this. There are people in the middle. Some libraries have installed filters because their board said, that's what we're going to do, end of story, and has been that way from the beginning. Excuse me. The federal government has come in and finally got a law that was considered constitutional called the Children's Internet Protection Act, or CIPA, mm-hmm. that says if you're going to receive certain kinds of federal funds from us, you have to filter your public access machines. And so a lot of libraries that had been against this idea ended up doing it because they rely on those funds.
Which libraries rely more on those funds, larger metropolitan libraries or smaller rural areas?
It's across the board.
Okay.
It really is. Some libraries, though, said it was going to cost them more to install the filters than they ever got from the federal government in the first place. Other libraries, they just had to because they got so much money from those granting systems. So it really does vary. Some libraries do filtering. Some libraries don't.
Hmm. And I guess the big question here is, can you regulate people's behavior?
Well, wow.
Small question.
Yeah, exactly. Yes and no. Where I think that's coming from is my opinion on filtering. I'm not for anybody can do anything they want on a computer in public. There are just certain things you shouldn't be doing in public, and there are certain things that are
like what? I'm just kidding. We don't have to talk about those things.
This is a family show.
Okay.
And illegal is illegal. So let's just lay that out flat. If you're doing something illegal, we're going to kick you out of the library. We're probably going to call the cops, whatever the policy is.
And illegal could be something as, downloading child porn to to downloading music illegally, right?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. how do libraries – obviously there are programs like NetNanny and things like that. But how do libraries – what kind of keywords do they use? How do they catch – people.
What a lot of this filtering software does is they create categories that the installer of the software, the library in this case, can say, okay, we want to block the following categories. But most of these software packages don't actually tell you exactly how they're doing it or exactly what's on those lists per se, because it's proprietary information. They have competitors. They don't want to release their algorithms and their lists because some other competitor might do it better than them based on their information. So when whether it be a library or a corporation or anybody installs this, you're kind of passing off the job of what is appropriate and what isn't to a third party. The way I look at it is treat it as a behavior issue. Back to your question, you know, have a behavior policy that says, you know, you're in a public place, you're allowed to do certain things, you're not allowed to cause a ruckus, you're not allowed to start a fight in the parking lot, whatever, and say, look, if somebody complains, we're going to check into what's going on, see if the complaint's justified, and if so, treat it accordingly. Instead of these blanket statements of you are not allowed to do X, I think kind of treating everything on a case-by-case basis makes it a little more flexible and fair.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break. And when we continue our conversation, when we come back and continue our conversation, we'll talk a little bit more about what is and isn't allowed to be seen on library computers. And we'll ask our listeners, do you use library computers? And do you have problems with censorship of materials? Our number, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also post a comment on our discussion board at kcur.org/uptodate. Sitting in for Steve Kraske, I'm Steven Steigman, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steven Steigman. Steve Kraske is away today. We're talking today with Michael Sowers, also known as the traveling librarian with the Nebraska Library Commission. We were talking before the break about how libraries kind of restrict some of the material you can view on the internet and what kind of filters they use. If you'd like to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also go to our website and post on our discussion board. That's kcur.org/uptodate and look for Join the Discussion. Let's take a call here from Chris here in Kansas City. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just want to pat you on the back for having a show about libraries today. And I lived in Omaha for 18 years, and the Nebraska Library Commission is near and dear to my heart. I'm a librarian at UMKC, and I'm traveling also today to Columbia because I teach library science. So welcome, Michael. I just wanted to go back real quick. You talked about electronic journals. And at UMKC, for example, just to give you an academic slant on this, we have over 20,000 electronic journals available, and we can actually tell exactly how many times those get used. We do not know who uses them precisely. That's, you know, we protect that privacy of the patron, but we know exactly every year how many hits those things are getting, and it's thousands and thousands and thousands. So, you know, to our community, they're very valuable.
Sure. Well, do you have any idea how much UMKC or area universities pay for rights to 20,000 journals online?
Well, I certainly do, but I think I better not say on the air.
Our airwaves might burst or something.
They're very pricey. I mean, the social sciences and humanities are typically less expensive. But where you get into the very costly things are the sciences and the medical areas. I mean, some medical is free because it's government subsidized, but, you know, the private publishers are very, very pricey. And if you look at their bottom line of those publishers, they make millions and millions in profit. And I won't get into that anymore. But I do want to also say that Kansas City has a wealth of resources through the Kansas City Public Library, Mid-Continent Public Library in Johnson County. They all have terrific databases. And when I go out and teach, I always ask my students, how many of you have public library cards? And they all raise their hands. And I say, how many of you are using the databases? And very few even know that they're there. So Michael's absolutely right. We need to promote these things. I just went down to talk to a business downtown a couple weeks ago, and they realized they can save thousands of dollars by using a free public library database, million-dollar directory. So there, I just encourage the community to get out and see what's available. Talk to your librarian, especially if you're in business. There's all kinds of fantastic pricey business databases free at your fingertips that you can use right from your office.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for the call. Okay. And Michael Sowers, tell us, first of all, how do libraries market sexy databases? how do they do that?
Well, if somebody can figure out how to make databases sexy, then they should tell me.
Check out my database.
Yeah, exactly. Well, although I do know of one university that did a podcast called Meet the Databases. And they had one librarian interviewing another one, and that librarian was acting as if they were that database.
Oh, interesting.
And it kind of gave them a little personality, and I thought that was great. One thing I'll add, too, is most of these databases through your local public library can be accessed from home as long as you have an internet connection. You don't have to go into the library to do it in many cases. You know, it's the internet. You need to go through the library's website, usually put in your library card number to prove you're a patron. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, you don't even have to leave home or, you know, get dressed if you don't want to.
Let's take a quick question here from Lorraine in Kansas City. Lorraine, thanks for holding for us.
Yes, thanks for your program. I really enjoy it. Welcome to Michael, and thank you, Steve, for filling in for the other Steve.
Pleasure.
I'm not a librarian. I was studying to be a librarian. Over the years, I have designed what I think is a new search engine that may give Google some competition or at least some a new way to cooperate. I ran my utility patent design past a Texas State Library Network developer. He says that I have a discovery tool and wants to see a proposal. I've relocated this concept to Kansas City, Missouri, and it looks like I have the opportunity, if I can find the correct partner, such as Michael, to patent a new search engine and come up with a new public library concept that would add value to the library. What's happening now is it looks like there's somewhat of censorship by default because people aren't getting access to geography. The question I had originally posed was, to what extent are the libraries working with the ARL, Association of Research Librarians, GIS Literacy Project, which was co-sponsored by a outstanding international software developer, ESRI, some time ago.
Lorraine, let's get an answer to your question. Michael, do you know, tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the particular project, but geographic information systems is the idea of taking data and plotting it out geographically.
Mm-hmm.
Various databases do this. There are projects I'm aware of that are out there. A lot of corporations use GIS data. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all cities and municipalities use GIS like there's no tomorrow because they got to figure out where to put the manhole covers and things like that.
Sure.
So libraries are taking advantage of it where they can, but a lot of those systems are not very cheap either. So,
sure.
You know, you got to figure out where the money needs to go.
Well, are teachers using GIS to geographic information systems to teach courses in history, for example? Let's say you wanted to teach about the Civil War and could you kind of show someone plot it on a map or on a visual way, you know, this is where the cavalry went and
yeah. Anything from Google Maps mm-hmm. to something like Microsoft's Visual Earth, where you can create your own custom maps based on whatever data you want to put into it. I mean, there's plenty of sites that are like, you put in your zip code, it'll plot on a map where the local Starbucks is. I mean, so, you know, at a certain level.
And that's more important than Civil War.
Well,
let's just get that on the record.
Exactly.
I want to know where to get my latte. Well, Michael, I've always been under the assumption that every book I check out is in my permanent records. So is it?
No. Incorrect. Pretty much most libraries will not keep any record of what you've checked out of the library. In many cases, there's state law that says that those records are private.
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario, a lot of systems will – you can look up a particular book. It will tell you the last person who had it.
Mm-hmm.
So if they find some damage in the book or something like that, they need to track down who had it last. That's fine. But no, a librarian cannot go into your record and say, here's all the books you've checked out over the last 30 years.
Well, if the FBI wanted to come in and take a look at Steven Steigman, well, let's make a bet. If the FBI wanted to come in and take a look at Steve Kraske's library checkout list, could they?
At a minimum, most libraries are going to insist on some sort of subpoena.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that be through the Patriot Act or local judge or, you know, even if it's the police, something like that. Some libraries over the years have not requested that.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some stories recently of one library where the FBI came in and said, we want those three computers. And the director said, okay, here you go.
Hmm.
that tends to make some news in the library world when that happens, because that's not generally considered standard operating procedure.
I mean, I have to believe that there's some level of intimidation. You got a couple of FBI guys coming in saying, Patriot X says, I'm going to stick you in Guantanamo if you don't give us.
Well,
not
I mean,
quite
I,
like that
I,
bad.
I don't want to necessarily be too cynical about law enforcement.
Right.
But I'm sure, you know, if a cop walked up to me and demanded to see my ID, and I know my rights are that I don't have to show him my ID, I'm probably going to show him anyways, because there's a built-in intimidation factor.
Sure, but suppose he says, I want to see your phone.
I might ask him at least why, but I'd like to think I would do that. I haven't actually had that happen to me yet.
And have there been some cases recently that you know of, some specific cases where people where they've come in and they've just kind of given the computers away freely?
Yes, and I don't remember the name of the library, and I think even if I did, I probably don't want to get too specific at this point. But but then looking at it from the library's point of view, the library might say, well, you know, we're doing our part.
Mm-hmm.
They claimed it was terrorism involved, so we want to do that. But there are these principles in the library world of open access and private, and if you're going to come into a public institution to look something up, you should feel comfortable that we're not going to go just telling anybody what it is you're looking up.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Steven Steigman. We're talking with Michael Sowers from the Nebraska Library Commission. Let's take our phone number, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 if you have questions about libraries and information technology. You can also join our conversation online at kcur.org/uptodate and look for Join the Discussion. Joan from Mission, Kansas. Joan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Stephen Michael. It's a wonderful program. I have to tell you that I've been doing genealogy for about the last 12 years, and the internet has been a wonderful thing for me, specifically because I can go on there and find out what other libraries have in their databases, mm-hmm. and what information they have. I've been going to the new Mecca, which is Mid-Continent Public Library and Independence, their new genealogical library, which is just magnificent. And it really cuts my research in time in half the time I have to find things. First I have to find it, and then I have to go look for it. Well, this way I can do it at home. I can get on the internet, look for it at home, and then go to the library in hand and say, I need this, and I can go find it. Or I can contact other libraries and have them send the information to my library. The only thing I wish is that the internet was more specific. The biggest problem I have is, even with Boolean searches, is getting things down to less than, you know, let's give me 100 replies, not 1,000 replies.
I have an easy way. Just put in Steven Steigman. You'll come up with like 4.
And if you put in my name, you'll get a lot more than that.
Okay.
He's much more popular. I'm better looking. He's much more popular.
Okay.
Joan, thank you very much for the call today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Michael, Wikipedia, I love it. You probably do, mm-hmm. secretly. Well, maybe
no,
openly.
Not so secretly.
Well, for listeners who don't know Wikipedia, quickly describe what Wikipedia is.
Well, a wiki is basically a website anybody can edit.
Okay.
Wikipedia is the 800-pound gorilla of wikis today. And mm-hmm. it's the idea of it's an online encyclopedia where anybody can go in and edit the content. So it's one of those things. I think that the phrase is it shouldn't work in theory, but it does work in practice. If anybody can change it, how could it be accurate? But if you look at it, it is surprisingly accurate, mm-hmm. because people want it to be accurate.
But there's a risk that that might not always be the case.
Well, yeah, there's been some talk about, right now you have X number of good people trying to put in good information. You have Y number of people trying to put in bad information or inaccurate information, or try to game the system to get an opinion across. And if the people trying to game the system start to ever outnumber the people trying to make the system good, it could collapse. But so far, it seems to be holding its own quite well.
And there are other types of wikis.
Oh, there's plenty. Wikipedia tries to cover pretty much everything, but we have wikis at the Nebraska Library Commission just for staff behind the scenes, mm-hmm. so we can, talk to each other and work on documents together. I think I was talking the other day to someone about the Muppet Wiki. Pretty much, if you need to know something about the most obscure Muppet in the world, or,
Snuffleupagus.
He's not even obscure.
Oh,
the piano guy on Sesame Street would bang
his
head on
that
thing. Don Cornelius. Whole page, just on him. But so, you get these specialized wikis on particular topics, and you get every single geek in the world who is interested in just that topic and nothing else,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be an amazing resource mm-hmm. on that particular topic.
Let's talk a little bit about Creative Commons. Okay. What are the Creative Commons?
The Creative Commons was something started by Lawrence Lessig about 10 years ago. And the idea was that there are plenty of problems with copyright as it stands today. You know, it's practically lifetime plus 70-something years when you create something. The copyright owners maybe have a little too much control in some people's ideas. The concept of fair use has maybe almost disappeared in other cases. His idea was that a creator can decide in advance what rights they want to give to the thing they created.
Hmm.
So, for example, I take a lot of photographs. I put them on my Flickr account.
Mm-hmm.
And I assign a Creative Commons license that says you are allowed to use this photo as long as, A, you cite me as your source, mm-hmm. so you give me credit, and you use it for non-commercial purposes. So instead of going randomly out on the internet and having to find a picture for something and then contact somebody and say, can I use this, and maybe fear of getting sued if I don't get permission, mm-hmm. things like that, you can go to Flickr. You can say, just give me stuff that allows non-commercial use. And you know as the user that you're fine with using it without having to ask anybody.
How many of the pictures on Flickr are labeled as Creative Commons?
Again, I don't have an exact number.
A lot?
A lot, yes. However, the default in something like Flickr is a traditional copyright, all rights reserved.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who know about it use it.
Mm-hmm.
I found, and in most cases, I've known of a few people that kind of have a bad experience under Creative Commons, so they decided to go back to traditional copyright. But in most cases, once you explain it to people, especially us amateurs who aren't necessarily trying to make any money mm-hmm. off of our photographs or our music or whatever, although I have made a couple of bucks,
hey, congratulations.
You know, we like to do it just so, you know, we like to share our work, and
sure.
that's the point of it.
And how do you, with that, I know it's a little hard to do this in an audio only format, but when you're on Flickr, how do you designate whether or not something's your traditional copyright or if you want to make a Creative Commons?
Well, in your account settings, you can set a global license. So
okay.
you can say everything I upload from this point forward applies to this particular license. In a couple of cases, I'll upload photos to my account that say maybe my father took. So that's not my right to give away because mm-hmm. I didn't take the photo. So I'll go in and change the properties of that particular photo to a different license.
Hmm. Tell me, there's a little bit of a difference between print books and music when it comes to how I can use each. Describe that.
Well, this gets into kind of where a lot of people see that there are significant problems with our traditional method of copyright in a digital environment. With your print book, as I'll specify a little more particularly as mm-hmm. opposed to electronic books, you buy the book, it's yours. You can read it in the bathtub, you can read it on an airplane, you can cut it up and turn it into a work of art, you can resell it, you can give it away to somebody.
You can use it as a doorstop.
You can use it as a doorstop, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some books are, that's about what they're worth.
Mm-hmm. James Michener. I remember a scene from The Simpsons, James Michener, like 69 cents a pound.
There you go.
On sale.
Yes, exactly. but in the digital world, music being the most seen at this point and heard, actually, as opposed to electronic books, which are not as popular, in a lot of cases, you're being told what you are and not allowed to do with that item. You know, mm-hmm. a DVD would probably be the best example
okay.
in that, yes, you're buying a physical item, but what you also have is a license to view that on a player in the United States. They have region coding. You can't go over to France and play a US DVD. Now, technically it is possible, but in that case, you're technically breaking the license and you're doing something illegal.
Okay. But so I can't make a copy of it for myself?
Not technically, legally, no.
Suppose I need a backup copy.
Well, you know, I'm not saying it's not possible,
uh-huh.
but technically that would be breaking the license, and the RIAA could sue you for that.
And how often does the RIAA actually come after people?
well, actually, in the case of video, it would be the MPAA, the Motion Picture
right.
Association of America, and in RIAA is the Recording Industry Association of America, and they're constantly going after people for violating what they see as their copyright.
Hmm.
Perfect example, a woman put up a 29-second video on YouTube of her little toddler dancing around the kitchen mm-hmm. with Prince's Let's Go Crazy playing in the background on the radio.
Yeah.
They, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, issued a takedown notice to YouTube and had the video taken down because, according to the whichever music company owned the rights to that song, they said she was violating copyright. She's now suing against them. It's been put back up, but she's suing for a judgment against the music company saying, that was fair use and you should not have told me to be able to take that down.
Well, let that be a lesson to UpToDate listeners that if you try to use the UpToDate music for your toddler in the background, we are going to come at – no, we won't do that. Well, let's say I want to download a song from iTunes. I bought the song. What can I do with that song?
If I remember the license correctly, you can have it on up to 5 computers and you can burn it to a CD. But after that, you're really not allowed to do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a couple other interesting stories along those lines where Microsoft said they were going to do this and then backed off. And I think Yahoo has since done it. Music that you purchased through their system over the last couple of years, they said, well, we're not going to do the system anymore. So we're going to take the system down. And all that music you bought from us, unless you go burn it to 1,000 CDs or however much music you bought, it's not going to work anymore.
How does that physically work? Can they go into your computer and
Well, what's going on is when you downloaded the music, yeah. your computer is checking back to one of their computers to say, does this person have the right to listen to that song?
Oh.
If they take those computers down, that music you bought won't play anymore.
Oh, interesting.
So now Microsoft backed off and said, okay, well, we'll keep that machine running for another couple of years. I think it was Yahoo. I could be wrong, but I think it was Yahoo just said, you know what? You're out of luck. Sorry. For taking it down.
Well, what's the path here? I mean, is this going to continue like this, or what do you predict 5-10 years from now?
Well, I hope it's not going to continue like that. I mean, it as much as I love digital technology and I use it all the time, the problem is that when you have licensing as opposed to actual purchasing, you're giving somebody else control over stuff you've purchased, and if they decide to not allow you to use it anymore, you're out of luck.
Hmm. Michael Sowers is the traveling librarian from the Nebraska Library Commission. He speaks this evening at 6 o'clock at the Linda Hall Library of Science, Engineering, and Technology, 5109 Cherry Street in Kansas City. More information is on our website at kcur.org. Michael Sowers, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Republican presidential candidate John McCain and his running mate Sarah Palin are in Lee's Summit right now. In fact, John McCain is speaking to a crowd. KCUR's Dan Verbeck joins us on the phone from the rally. Dan, thanks for stepping out for a moment.
Stephen, it's good to be with you as always. The senator is wrapping up his second speech. He gave one outside because there were 2,000-3,000 people who couldn't make it into the FedEx Pavilion. And so a couple of thousand outside. He stopped and spoke for about 5 minutes, as did Sarah Palin. The governor spoke to the people outside and then again inside.
How many people are inside at the event?
2,500 is what the hall holds, I'm told, and it filled up early.
Tell us about the setup. What's it like there? Describe the scene for us.
Well, it's kind of damp, but cloudy. It's right next to the Lee Summit Hospital. It's a big pavilion. A lot of people out with not so many elementary school-age children, but a lot of babes in arms.
Mm-hmm.
A number of parents said that they wanted to be able to tell their children when they were grown that they saw who they hoped to be, the President of the United States, when they were a year old or less.
Hmm. Well, Sarah Palin's really given Republicans a huge bump in the polls. What's the crowd like been towards her out there in Lee Summit?
Well, here's one indicator. A woman who has a stand-up selling sweatshirts and T-shirts said that things had gotten kind of stagnant in the sales at various events until Sarah Palin got on the ticket. They put her name on the T-shirts, and they're selling hotcakes.
They're selling, like, hotcakes?
Yeah.
Well, do you know if Governor Palin is going to do any interviews after the rally today?
I'm not aware of that. I haven't been able to get in close enough to the handlers to find that out. But she has a definite ability to communicate with a crowd, especially when she speaks with a great passion of John McCain's war record. The biggest explosion of applause has to come when they mention the patriotism in the same sentence as John McCain and his experience as a prisoner of war during Vietnam.
Well, why are places like Lee's Summit so important to both candidates this year, both Obama and McCain?
Well, Lee's Summit is a stronghold of the Republican Party in the Eastern Jackson County suburbs, Blue Springs, another place. It didn't used to be that way, but in the last 20 years or so, there's a tide has gone very strongly toward the Republicans out in this part of Eastern Jackson County. It's friendly territory, and the senator's message of and a lot of the recurring themes from the up at the convention are being heard. It's almost like we're hearing an echo from St. Paul of some of the topics of we're going to drain the swamp in Washington. Nuclear power is the answer. It's safe. Let's quit giving money to nations where the people don't like us very much. And of course, a considerable attack on Senator Obama and as a free-spending liberal.
Well, Obama has opened up an office out in Lee's Summit. Did you see any Obama supporters out there today?
Not a one out here.
None at all. So there was no organized opposition.
No, it's a little remote out here, granted, and it's a little hard to get into.
Uh-huh.
But among the people who are standing with any kind of protest signs along the sides of the road leading in, it's mostly saying let's increase veterans' benefits. But I've seen no direct attacks on Senator McCain.
Well, Dan Verbeek, thank you so much.
Always good to be with you, Stephen.
That's KCUR's Dan Verbeek. As a reminder, Michael Sauer, the traveling librarian, speaks this evening at 6 at the Linda Hall Library of Science, Engineering, and Technology. You'll find more information on our website at kcur.org/uptodate. You'll also find more information about our guest, this week's program lineup, archived editions of previous broadcasts, and a link to sign up for our free daily podcast. Again, all at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Steve Kraske returns to discuss women in politics. How far have we come? Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Frank Morris, Kara Caldwell, and Danny Alexander. I'm Steven Steigman, sitting in for Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.